KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture, the inaugural show for the fall 2013 quarter. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thanks for joining me today on the show. Today I'm very excited to have on Professor Anupam Chander of UC Davis Law School, author of the new book, The Electronic Silk Road, How the Web Binds the World Together in Commerce. Anupam's work is work that many IP and technology scholars are very familiar with, being a prolific scholar. And in this book, Anupam has brought together a number of topics that he has written about in the past, as well as a lot of additional information in raising this broad question, which is how we should think about the internet itself today in 2013 as a venue and a medium for trade and really for interaction between cultures. In the book, The Electronic Silk Road, and I think the dust jacket, the front flap of the dust jacket kind of sums it up, from China to Facebookistan, and we'll talk about that, the internet has transformed global commerce. A cyberlog expert, that would be Anupam, argues that we must free internet trade while simultaneously protecting consumers. So we're going to be focusing on that tension in the show today. The tension between trade and protecting the theoretical beneficiaries of trade, that is consumers, is of course a tension that in trade that goes back decades and centuries. Indeed, that is the title of the book, The Electronic Silk Road. And Anupam is drawing on that rich history of international trade to figure out what the internet does to those traditional notions of trade and commerce and interaction between cultures and businesses for that matter. And so over the course of this discussion, we are going to, aside from drawing those connections, think about the infrastructure, both legally and also and even technologically, that addresses these questions of trade. What is the electronic Silk Road today? And is that analogy a good one and an appropriate one today given all the changes that we have? So this is a wonderful topic. It's a topic that we have not discussed explicitly on the show, but we've definitely discussed a variety of these issues over the last 7+ years on Hearsay Culture. One of the main topics that I have been interested in on the show deals with broad issues of international trade and what we know and don't know about those issues. But in addition, we've also talked very, very specifically with a number of guests about questions of e-commerce, everything from the issues involving linking to websites that carry potentially copyright infringing materials, to issues involving how we move goods across lines, to how we deal with cybersecurity issues on the international and domestic agenda, to how we think about hackers. All of these issues tie into these broad questions because, of course, when we're dealing with questions of trade and e-commerce on the internet, we, of course, leave no one behind in the sense that the internet at this point is virtually existing in every country on the planet. Of course, the questions of internet penetration and how accessible the internet is, of course, varies widely from country to country, not only because of politics, but because of geography and resources. But in this book, we are going to dig deep into some of those issues in the time that we have and explore many, but not all, of the ideas and concepts that Anupam discusses in this book. By way of very brief background, Anupam is a professor of law at the University of California, Davis. He's also the director of the California International Law Center. He's taught at Yale, Chicago, Stanford, and Cornell. He's published in so many law reviews and had so many publications that simply you can say that he's been published widely in highly respected journals. He is joining us from his home in Davis, California. We were recording on September 20th for airing in the beginning of October 2013. Anupam, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, Dave, for inviting me.
Let's start off with a question that I ask all of my guests. Tell us a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in this topic.
So in 2003, I read two different sources of information. One was this Indian American paper called India Abroad, and another was the website that you're familiar with, Slashdot. And both were remarkably interested in the same topic, which was outsourcing. So in 2003, outsourcing became a kind of important issue in the American political debate, and especially in 2004 with the presidential election. And so I started thinking about, you know, the nature of work today, the nature of services, which suddenly became tradable. For the history of humankind, if you wanted to provide a service to someone, you had to travel to that person, or that person had to travel to you. So this is what Jagdish Bhagwati calls the haircuts view of services. Services are just non-tradable, except and must be delivered in person. And the internet changed that. And so that's how I kind of first began to be interested in the subject. And I wanted to figure out how we think of these things. And so, you know, part of it was kind of conceptualizing the problem because it hadn't been addressed in the legal literature at all. So to try to think of, you know, so I talk a lot in the book about questions of the composition of the firm. So the questions that Ronald Coase asked about make or buy. Do you make something inside your firm, or do you buy it from some vendor outside your firm? Do you use the market to purchase the input you need for your operation, or do you have an employee provide that input? So these are the kinds of questions that I turned to initially in trying to grapple with this new phenomenon.
Now, when we talk about these issues, and it ties directly to your last point here, we're talking about really a phenomena of trade. But as you say in the title, right, we can use this analogy or this metaphor of the electronic Silk Road. And it's obviously a very rich analogy. Perhaps I'll just ask you up front, which we'll get into your thesis and your focus, but what do you mean literally by the electronic Silk Road? What image or what idea are you trying to conjure with that title?
So I saw the Silk Road as a connection between civilizations. So a way for East and West to interact with each other and to share their goods at the time. So various products, manufactured products and even raw materials were transported across the Silk Road. And as you know, the Silk Road was actually not just a collection of roads. There was also a sea route from China over to essentially Africa. And the crossing, of course, the India along the way. So a lot of cultures and civilizations were participating in this incredible trade. What I realized was that this is exactly what's going on in cyberspace today, that you've got, returning to the outsourcing example, you've got now India providing services to the United States. That was kind of initially one of the kind of main set of services that were provided across this new highway. This recalls, of course, Al Gore's metaphor, the information superhighway. But I think the Silk Road is a little bit more evocative, but also really about commerce. It's a way that commerce flows across these vast distances. But I also understood that the Silk Road was not just about commerce. The Silk Road was ultimately about culture and information. So Buddhism, for example, spread along the Silk Road from India into China, into various parts of the East, and a lot of information flowed across these ways. And I think just as we have commerce as the first thing we might think about, we really have a lot of culture that's being shaped and reshaped using these tools.
Now I used it in my introduction, and I want to be clear about this. So, you know, when we think about trade, you know, broadly, I think many people would put that under the heading of e-commerce. But is that fair? Is that a fair generalization to use? Is your focus what we call e-commerce, or is it something else?
So often when we use the word e-commerce, we're simply imagine a website like eBay or Amazon, a website that helps you buy goods. And I think, of course, that's important. And I think that's really, I'm a huge fan of these websites. Generally, it allows consumers access to an amazing array of products, and so that they aren't captured by the retailer in their small town, for example. I grew up in a small town, and I know, the pressures on consumers from being held hostage to kind of local monopolists. Now, I understand, of course, that people will be concerned about the fact that Amazon is running independent booksellers out of business and things like that. And I know that that's a serious concern, so I don't want to deny that entirely, but I recognize that. So I was concerned about this kind of way that the internet empowered individuals to engage in commerce. But e-commerce for me meant something a lot broader. So it included services like Facebook, which don't seem on their face to be commercial. But of course, when we think about it for a little bit more than 1 second, we recognize that they are ultimately very commercial entities. So these are companies worth tens of billions of dollars, companies like Google, that are providing commercial services, that are engaged in e-commerce, perhaps not the way we have historically thought of as commerce, because we haven't even understood the kind of service that Facebook is providing, a social network, as fundamentally a commercial service. So my goal was to recognize the amount of the new kinds of trade that was actually occurring, that an app store was, in fact, a very significant bit of e-commerce that was now possible.
So is it fair to say, as an overriding concept, and we'll get into more details later, that there has been a significant transition away from goods as the rubric for trade and towards services? Because, of course, services, right, have been traded for a very long time. But is it a matter of the predominance of services, of the importance of services versus goods today? How would you describe that distinction as between the era of the Silk Road and now?
So services are increasingly the bulk of the GDP of economically advanced countries. But they are not the bulk of international trade. So commercial services are still significantly smaller than than goods in international trade. And both goods and services are increasing in their in international trade. So it's not even necessarily that services are an increasing bulk of international trade generally. Rather than compare and contrast one as more or less important than the other, though, I think that what my book tries to say is that if we just look at services are incredibly important. They are the way that many countries have found that they can retain people at home. If they're not going to be able to manufacture goods and become kind of exporters of goods, perhaps they can become exporters of services. And so countries across the world now are vying to become the new Bangalore or the new Silicon Valley.
So we're chatting with Professor Anupam Chandra of UC Davis, author of the book The Electronic Silk Road, How the Web Binds the World Together in Commerce. Anupam, I think you in some measure said it, but I do want to ask this question outright. So what is your thesis of this work?
So the thesis is that we are being increasingly bound together in commerce, often in ways that we haven't even recognized. And that this is generally a good thing, that enabling consumers to access services from around the world empowers consumers, enabling service providers to provide services across the world empowers service providers. And so this is potentially a win-win situation. Now, in any new revolutionary technological change, there are always people whose livelihoods will be affected adversely by them. And I think that is, and I want to acknowledge that certainly. I think that we need to make sure that there are programs in place to assist them that provide transition and education resources for these individuals. But overall, societies benefit with trade. This is a basic insight of economics. It's a fundamental insight of economics, and it's one that applies whether you're trading in widgets or trading in services. It doesn't matter that the object the target of the trade is a good or a service. The general view in economics is that the countries involved with trade both benefit from it.
Does the internet as the medium for trade change the politics of trade discussion? And this is something we can talk about a little later. But trade, as you know, is a controversial topic. We've had those controversies both nationally and internationally with NAFTA, with GATT, with the ongoing Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreements. And it's not just the substance of those agreements that people are concerned about, but as you know, it's the very notion of trading in these certain goods and services, or dealing with these with certain countries or certain products, and the impact domestically on jobs and living standards and so forth. All of that is by way of saying, does the fact that we're using the internet as a medium for trade change that analysis in your view?
That's a great question. As you recall, the 2003-2004 discussion of outsourcing resulted in a backlash against outsourcing. So in New Jersey, they passed a law that said you couldn't outsource government services contracts outside this country. So that is, you had to keep any contracts that provided services to the government of the state of New Jersey within the state, within the country. 2010, an executive order by Governor Ted Strickland in Ohio did the same thing for Ohio. Now, imagine if either of those states had barred the purchase of goods made outside the United States. I think there would have been an outcry across the board against that kind of protectionism. It would be outrageous, and it would, of course, be detrimental to the people of those two states. If those two states stopped purchasing goods made outside the country, they would find, first, that they couldn't get some goods that they really needed, and two, that they would be paying a lot more than they should. And third, that the goods may not be as high quality in some instances as those produced abroad. Now, this is this kind of mercantilist view expressed by those two states is one that, of course, beggars every state ultimately. It's a view that invites retaliation by foreign states, and it means that American farmers, American manufacturers, American service providers would ultimately be banned from those states as well. Now, you asked about the politics. The politics here, I think, have the possibility, again, of producing a win-win circumstance. So we understand that we often get services from countries like India and the Philippines or African countries, and those come to our shores, and we purchase them. But we are also enormous exporters of services. In fact, we are actually the world's leading net exporter of commercial services. We are by far the beneficiaries of international trade and services. So if we start shutting our borders to foreign services, then other countries will eventually retaliate, and this will harm us really directly. But it will harm a particular set of industries especially gravely. And there I'm speaking of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley now earns increasingly half or more than half of its income outside the United States. And so if you've conceptualized Google and Facebook, as I suggested at the start of this interview, as a commercial cross-border service, And you realize that if you bar trading the purchase of goods from foreign countries, well, for purchase of services from foreign countries, excuse me, those countries may well bar Silicon Valley. They could stop using Google services, and Google is increasingly wants to be used by governments and companies across the world, and of course by individuals across the world. And so we have to make sure that we don't act in a way that is so short-sighted, thinking that we can simply erect barriers to foreign traders and then hope still to be able to export freely to the world. That's just not the way the politics would work. And so really, instead, there is the possibility of a win-win situation where countries and companies and individuals provide services across the world freely, but thereby enriching consumers and businesses and individual service providers across the world in that process.
When we use the word network in connection with the trade that you're talking about, what does it mean exactly?
So, network was the first way I kind of conceptualized this before I came up with this metaphor of the electronic Silk Road.
Okay.
Which was a kind of better metaphor. I realized that network was exactly what people were involved with. This is work conducted over the net or facilitated by the net. Work that might have been able to be performed offline, but that the costs of providing that work to the customers of that work, to the consumers perhaps, were so prohibitive offline that they wouldn't typically be provided in that way. So network here is a way to recognize that the traditional network, this kind of electronic network, is empowering a new kind of work that is available to people across the world. And this includes not just traditional offshore services, but also the new breed of companies like Instagram or now owned by Facebook, or Pinterest, or Google or Facebook.
So we've got a number of terms of art here, and you've referred to a few of them, and that I think we've contextualized the discussion. We can dig a little deeper and more granular level into the concepts you're talking about. So and I should have said, when I said what does network mean, I really should have said net-work, which is how you use it in a book. Before we get to the concept of the trade plus regime, a couple of interesting phrases you use that I think bear noting. What do you mean by technological neutrality?
So what I suggest in the book is that sometimes we look at internet trade and we say, look, it's got problems. It's going to, the example I use in the book is gambling. So the United States looked at online gambling and it said, look, there are people who are committing fraud through online gambling. There are people who are gambling who are underage, there are people who are gambling who are problem addicted gamblers, and there's money laundering involved as well. And that's all true. That's all true. But if we go into a regular casino in the United States, or if you go to the history of Las Vegas in the United States, or any gambling area, those problems may well exist there as well. And so what we've done by singling out the online medium as the, as abetting these kinds of ills is to neglect the fact that the offline version of the service also shared plenty of ills, maybe in different amounts, maybe in different ways, but that money laundering in casinos as well. And what we've done then by barring the online version of the service is be non-neutral technologically. We have actually encumbered the new technology with a higher set of demands. kind of a regulatory nirvana, as I call it, that didn't exist in real space. So it is unfair, it's illegitimate under trade law, really, to ask of this online medium to comport with a regulatory nirvana that didn't exist in the offline version of that service.
So let me, and let me push back on that for a moment, at least to this extent. Is it fair to say that, and getting to my initial question, which how the internet makes things differently, that the impacts of internet trade and internet commerce versus, and I'm going to keep using the Silk Road as the comparator, are much vaster, which therefore justifies treating the internet differently. In other words, I could not, in the 19th century, sit in my apartment in the United States and gamble and impact the citizens of Antigua. But now I can. And so therefore, the pushback question is, isn't that a significant enough difference to, therefore, to treat internet trade as a different beast entirely?
I think there's something right about the premise, which is that the ability of people to reach each other across the world is radically different today. But your example, smacks of protectionism, right? You couldn't earlier, you said, have, sitting in Antigua, say, have reached an American consumer, gambling services consumer. So that's right. But now we have allowed for that the technology does make this possible in a way that the consumer might find congenial. And so if we now say, well, suddenly that becomes tradable, and now we need to stop it, that's exactly what protectionism is about. That is the very definition of protectionism. Once someone else is out there that can compete with us in delivering a service, we will now stop that person from providing that service. However, you can ask a different question, which is, can we be sure that there isn't a higher level of fraud than there was in the casino version of the service, that people will be assured their money back, that there isn't a higher level of money laundering, that we try to make sure that children aren't gambling? Yes, we should attend to all those traditional norms that are built into the expectations of our Las Vegas casinos, but we should simply ask those norms to be upheld as well by the online version of the service, regardless of where it's provided from, whether it's provided from Antigua or provided from Las Vegas.
We're chatting with Professor Adam Hom Chander, author of the book The Electronic Silk Road, How the Web Binds the World Together in Commerce, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU-FM, Stanford University, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU. And by the way, I've never said this before. There have been 192 shows, but I guess I could say this, that to the extent that you want to sponsor Hearsay Culture by way of a donation, I suppose you could do that also. Now, maybe I've just stepped in a problem, because I'm saying that largely off the cuff, and there may be people at KZSU right now or when they hear this who will say, no, you can't do that, Levine. But speaking of trade, to the extent that you want to underwrite KZSU by way of a donation that you could make via the internet, that's certainly something at least I would be open to. So if you're interested in exploring that, I guess I should say email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. So this is the impact of Adam Hom's work on me, that it's getting me thinking very creatively about how to generate revenue and to trade on the show. So Adam Hom, your answer before that very quick break, I think leads to one more term that I want to define, and it's probably the most perhaps the most mysterious term in the book, because I'm not familiar with it. Now, it doesn't mean I think you may have coined it, but you can correct me. What do you mean by glocalization?
So what I've done is borrowed a term from sociology. So in sociology, people worry about the kind of flattening effects of globalization, a kind of single global world culture. And so what they say is, instead, can we can we have the virtues of globalization, but reshaped by the local cultural circumstances so that they present themselves with a kind of local face. So what I've done is adapted that term to the law. And so essentially what I've suggested is that when we do have, and let's continue with the Antigua example, an Antiguan gambling services provider providing services to an American consumer, it is right for the United States to insist that the service provider conform his or her service to U.S. law. That law shouldn't be protectionist, so of course it should not be kind of disguised protectionism, a disguised way to keep the Antiguans out. But it should ask of the Antiguans something that is reasonable to ask of an American supplier as well. So in other words, just because you're receiving a service now through the free trade zone of the internet, we don't want to say that is you can do it without worrying about the law around the world, that you still need to worry about making sure that it complies with local law. Of course, that local law is, again, I just want to reiterate, should not be protectionist. And I have also suggested elsewhere in the book that the local law shouldn't be excessively onerous unnecessarily, that there will be many times that a local law is there, but it doesn't need to operate in the same way. It doesn't serve some very important domestic purpose, policy purpose. So in those cases, countries should be aware that they are affecting a global internet, and they should try as much as possible to see if they can find a solution that doesn't upset the worldwide nature of the web.
You know, the issue of protectionism is one that, of course, raises that broad question of what the internet is. And you write about it in a book, and we could talk about it a bit here, Google has struggled in figuring out how it exactly can and should do business in China. And, of course, it's received a lot of criticism given its catchphrase of do no evil. And then, as you know, people have criticized Google for in one way or another advancing the interests of the Chinese government that many people view as doing evil. In the midst of all this, right, you have this issue of protectionism. So China's view would be that China has a local economy, a local environment that it wishes to protect, and it doesn't want Google and its services trade interfering with it. Now, putting aside the normative question of whether China societies want to emulate, isn't that a fair argument in favor of protectionism, to use that phrase, more broadly, that the internet is, in fact, an intrusion? So my question is the internet an intrusion, or at least one that countries should regulate?
So China is a member of the World Trade Organization, and it was a late member to the WTO, and it had to negotiate actually special accession obligations. So it actually has more free trade obligations than others that came onto the WTO earlier on. And if China were to say simply, we want to support our domestic industry and not the Googles of the world, that would be a direct violation of its free trade commitments. So they haven't said that. They've said instead that we are trying to that such services, you know, they haven't said very much, but when they defend themselves, it's along the lines of kind of illicit material being provided through these services. And so they've said, I mean, their goal is censorship of unwanted a kind of illegal information within China, and their goal is not to help domestic industry over foreign industry. That certainly is the effect of the prohibition, but it's not the stated goal.
So where does Google fit into this equation? I mean, Google obviously, you know, is the most successful internet company so far. How can Google, as a services trader, impact in that environment?
It's a great question, and so I have a paper in the California Law Review called "Googling Freedom," which discusses what I believe are the corporate social responsibilities that new media, such as Google, owe to the people of unfree societies. So I suggest that Google, Facebook, etc., have an obligation in these places. Facebook is banned entirely. But that it has an obligation of to try to resist surveillance and kind of the monitoring obligations that information sharing obligations that these countries would like to impose. Google has tried, as you know, to Google has been, I think, really, I have to say, a leader in this effort. It found that when it placed its servers in mainland China, that it was facing a lot of pressure for censorship and perhaps even surveillance, and so it decided that it would pull them to Hong Kong, which is, as you know, rather freer, though not as free as we are in the United States, certainly. So Google has tried to be a kind of responsible custodian of information vis-a-vis the Chinese government and the Chinese people. Obviously, people have criticized Google and all the other Silicon Valley companies for being part of this kind of NSA surveillance scheme. And of course, those companies have fought back to saying, you know, we've resisted, you know, these expansive requests, and we are trying to do whatever we are. We are forced to do things by the law, but that we may not necessarily like some things that we are being asked to do.
Let's talk a little bit, and we're getting close to what I call the unfair portion of the show, and that's when I start asking you questions that you don't have enough time to answer in the time that we have left. But I do it as a radio host, and any good radio host should. You write, and I think this is really interesting as we think about trade more broadly, that trade itself, in a sense, is voluntary. And you write in a book, and I recognize that I'm taking one sentence and I'm pulling it out of a larger chapter, so I do want you to contextualize it better than I will. But you write, "I've argued elsewhere that the voluntary nature of national acquiescence to such processes," and by that you mean transnational trade, "makes them compatible with democracy." And that's a really interesting statement, particularly in light of the pushback that have been coming from many quarters involving at least current international trade regimes like Trans-Pacific Partnership that have not been as transparent, that have not been as open to input from stakeholders outside of certain industries and so forth. Putting aside really the particulars of TPP, can you explain that in a little bit more detail? How this regime of international trade, with the internet being as dominant as it is voluntary and in that way compatible with our notions of democracy?
Sure. And the reference there is, there are footnotes in this book, as you know.
Of course.
So the reference there is to my paper, "Globalization and Distrust," which is in the Yale Law Journal now quite a while back. And so in that paper, the question that I ask is whether international law is inconsistent with democracy, whether democracy requires that all law be made within a country. And because international law, by definition, is formulated in kind of international venues, it might then be potentially undemocratic or inconsistent with democracy. that's the claim that is offered by critics of international law. And so I challenge that claim by pointing out that, you know, so imagine instead of democracy, imagine two people. You know, you and I agree that we will have a podcast at a shared time. So we, you know, we set aside on our calendar this particular moment, and we've committed to it. By that process, kind of, you know, not doing other things during that time, et cetera. But that's not done entirely by me. You know, you and I collaborated in that process. You proposed a time. I proposed maybe a date. And we finally settled on something together at a certain time. So in other words, I have, in that sense, you know, agreed to a kind of international consensus, you and I as separate nations now. And that actually enhances our autonomy, because our ability to contract is, in fact, the very essence of human autonomy. It actually expands our power by entering into these kind of contracts with other players. It doesn't, in fact, circumscribe our autonomy to be involved in these relations. And that, of course, is what international law is like as well. That international law allows us increased power. We might agree on climate change. We might agree to ban chemical weapons. We might agree on nuclear, on a regime for nuclear power and nuclear weapons. So those are all things that expand our national sovereignty by collaborating with other nations. They don't, in fact, bind us in negative ways. So that's what I mean, that these international processes are, in fact, ones that enhance our national power, not detract from them. So if we enter into the WTO, we've committed to liberalizing trade and gambling, I think, but that is only because ultimately, by liberalizing trade and gambling, we are helping ensure that all countries are liberalizing trade, that makes the whole world more prosperous, and it benefits us by being party to this kind of international regime. So international law is a way, like a contract that you and I might sign, a way to expand our power and to increase collaboration in the world, which is, as I said, kind of the possibility of a win-win for all countries. In any one case, it may turn out that a contract proved not to your advantage, but in general, the ability to contract, the ability to engage in treaties, will be beneficial for people as well as countries.
We're chatting with Professor Anupam Chander, of UC Davis Law, author of the book The Electronic Silk Road: How the Web Binds the World Together in Commerce. So, of the various international trade regimes that are out there, Anupam, in your view, do any of them come close or do well in encompassing the kinds of principles that you would like to see come out of international law and regulation involving internet trade?
Great question. You know, we've started along this process, and as I said at the start when you asked, how I came up with this, I had to start conceptualizing how to think about these things. And so, you know, terms like globalization and dematerialization that we haven't discussed are ones that I came up with to kind of think about what we need to do as we move forward. I think we're still a ways away. Now, the European Union has been thinking about a single market for goods and services long before us. And so I think the European Union has been more advanced in its thinking, really, with respect to this, and so kind of creating a free trade area for services. And I think we might learn from the Europeans as we kind of figure this all out. They've asked countries to return to my dematerialization concept, for example.
Right.
You know, every country has to indicate, has to have an inquiry point so that foreign suppliers can turn to that inquiry point and get the rules that they need to know in order to supply services into that country. And I think things like that are important. And so the GATS has similar things that try to move towards an easier infrastructure for the international trade in services. So the GATS, by that I mean the General Agreement on Trade in Services, one of the three foundational agreements of the World Trade Organization in 1995.
In the remaining time that we have, which is about 7 minutes or so, it's important, I think, because we are talking particularly about the Silk Road, but also we referred to it before. You know, we should talk a bit about the impact of the BRIC countries on trade today, in your perspective. And BRIC is an acronym for BRIC: Brazil, Russia, India, China. There's obviously been a lot of writing, both in mainstream media as well as scholarly, regarding BRIC countries, but I want to narrow this question to, again, the internet itself and the kinds of issues that you're focusing on. Broadly conceived, what is the impact of the BRIC countries themselves on internet trade as you define it?
It's a great question. So the BRIC countries are crucial to this, and of course it turns out that they are, you know, at least two of them very important parts of the ancient Silk Roads, India and China, and Russia, of course, you know, close in that orbit. So these countries, I think, are, you know, obviously really important players in the global internet. China actually has more global, people who are connected to the internet than any other country in the world. And it now has some of the world's biggest internet companies, many of which have listings in the United States. And so they are really quite substantial enterprises that are doing really interesting things within China. India, of course, has largely become the world's back office. I mean, as I say in the book, you know, the United Kingdom, the United States are also huge exporters of services. And so they really are also the world's back office as well. So India alone is not the champion of services. There are many other countries. The Philippines has now become the world's largest center of call centers. And so if you're talking with someone on the phone who is doing customer service in the United States, you may very well be speaking with someone in the Philippines. Try it out. I routinely ask very politely where someone is, and I think you'll often find that the person is sitting in the Philippines. So I think those countries, the BRIC countries, are very important. And I haven't talked about Brazil, but of course Latin America is also emerging as a very important part of the global economy. And Brazil has relied a lot upon its commodities, which it has a plenty, but it is increasingly a powerhouse in services as well. And so these countries will continue to be important players. Russia is an interesting entity. Russia has tons of computer engineers, but it's also turned out to be kind of sometimes a scofflaw in these contexts. It supported a website that I discuss in the book called AllFMP3, mm-hmm. that really allowed anyone. It ripped off all music CDs of the United States and the West and other countries, but it offered very marginal royalties to the copyright holders of those works, but yet sold these things to the West for very cheap, as I say, an entire album for the price of one iTunes. It was a kind of a really potentially piratical website. And the United States finally pressured the Soviet Union to shut down this website only through the hope of the WTO to become a member of the, the hope of Russia to become a member of the WTO. So we used our kind of effective veto of Russian entry into the WTO as a way to ensure that Russia treated our intellectual property with a little bit more respect.
And of course that issue is one that has in large measure framed a lot of the discussions of trade, and I think it created some of the barriers that might not otherwise exist to the kinds of quote-unquote free trade that you talk about in the book. Like I said, Anupam, go ahead, yeah.
So, Dave, of course, you're thinking, of course, of the Stop Online Piracy Act.
I am.
And so, of course, you're absolutely right on this, so that our kind of desire to protect American intellectual property outside U.S. borders has been so sometimes overzealous that it's actually undermined the Internet generally. And that was certainly the case with the Stop Online Piracy Act. Your listeners may not be aware that you were one of the leaders of the effort to stop it, and I really was very grateful for all your efforts.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, it's I certainly to the extent that listeners pay attention to what I'm doing outside the radio show, which I don't talk about much on the show. That was certainly something I focused on heavily, and frankly, it was the primary concern to me was restructuring the internet away from something which as much as is possible could move information neutrally, which really gets to the last question. And remember, I said unfair, Anupam, and now I'm going to prove how unfair I can be, because underlying all of this are the recent revelations involving NSA spying and of course calling into question the very nature of the internet and what it is that we think we had, or what we have now as a communication medium. And I'm just curious for you, and I said unfair, meaning you now have 1 minute to answer this question. Does the NSA spying issue in any way impact any of your conclusions or even your analysis of trade that contained in your book, The Electronic Silk Road?
I think the NSA spying is one of the kind of mortal dangers to the internet, and especially a mortal danger to the U.S. Silicon Valley. I say in the book that Chinese internet companies, regardless of how large they are, have been largely unsuccessful in becoming global players, because very few people will trust their information to these Chinese companies that must abide by a surveillance state. If the United States is a surveillance state, will Indians, Brazilians, Russians, Germans, French people, Nigerians trust their information to American companies if they think that the American companies are spies for the U.S. government? The American companies are fighting back, they're trying to say, no, we're trying to resist this, but the United States has not done enough to ensure that there are legal protections available for foreign information in the hands of American companies.
Anupam Chander, professor at UC Davis Law, author of the book The Electronic Silk Road, How the Web Binds the World Together in Commerce, published by Yale University Press. Anupam, thank you so much for joining us on the show. I mean, and virtually all my guests have this problem. We can only really touch the tip of the iceberg. As you mentioned, there were some core concepts in the book that we weren't able to spend much time on, which is my opening to invite you back on the show, but more importantly, to thank you for educating my listeners today.
Thank you so much, Dave. This was a lot of fun.
So we are recording this show in mid-September when I am in the process of putting together my list of guests for the fall quarter. So over the next week or so, and certainly by the time this show airs, I will have a schedule posted. So rather than rattle off potential names, I will simply say that I am in the process of doing that. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show, and again, at the time I'm recording this, I do not know when the show will air on KZSU for the fall quarter, so I'll simply say you can hear it on KZSU. KZSU FM live at some point during a given week. This show, being the first show to air in a full quarter, means that by the time you hear this, you will know what time that is. But alternatively, if you're not going to listen live on KZSU by either tuning in the Bay Area or by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu, you can get the show via podcast. And there are several ways to do that. You can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous 192 shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. You can go to the Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or go to CIS's iTunes page, where you can get not only Hearsay Culture, but all other events occurring at CIS. I should mention, I mentioned this at the end of last quarter, and emphasize it, that I am, in fact, this quarter should be, ultimately, the 200th show anniversary for Hearsay Culture, and I've gotten some really interesting suggestions on what I should do for that 200th show. I'm not going to say anything much more about it now, but I will simply mention that if you have any suggestions on what I should do for the 200th show, hopefully the suggestion isn't end it, but short of ending the show, email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Additionally, I'm happy to announce that Hearsay Culture will now be airing monthly on Freirag Radio in Innsbruck, Austria, a public radio station in Innsbruck that is going to air the show basically one a month in Innsbruck. So I should mention as well that to the extent that you are familiar with or are interested in having Hearsay Culture air on a radio station near where you live or one that you think would be of interest, please email me that as well at dave@hearsayculture.com. Important to note, however, that I distribute the show via Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license, which means two things. First, quite frankly, people don't necessarily have to even ask my permission, although it's a nice courtesy, to air the show. But more importantly, that I'm not looking to sell the show. As longtime listeners know, I make $0 on this show, which, you know, certainly is frustrating when I want to buy, you know, a new flat-screen TV. But nonetheless, I do that. So I'm not looking to sell the show, but to the extent that someone wants to distribute it through a Creative Commons share-alike and attribution policy, please let me know. Thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture. Hope you've enjoyed the show today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.